KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law in Greensboro, North Carolina, as well as a fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. I'm very excited to have on the show today Professor Chris Kelty from UCLA. He's an associate professor in the Information Studies Department and Center for Society and Genetics. He ultimately, as he will describe his background in more detail, is an anthropologist. And we are going to be discussing today his book from 2008, Two Bits, The Cultural Significance of Free Software. The ideas of open source and free software are topics that we have come to several times on the in the history of Hearsay Culture, starting with an early interview that I did at the beginning of the show, the beginning of the show's run back in 2006 with Professor Larry Lessig. But it has moved forward, and we've had discussions with others that are interested in open collaboration and other efforts that go outside the traditional models of innovation that we think about generally when we think about how products come to market and how goods and services are produced. So I've had on the show a few times Professor Hank Chesbrough from Berkeley, who has written very interesting work on a business side on open business models. And I'm very excited today to have on someone who's been thinking about these issues for quite a long time and who wrote a fascinating book, Chris Kelty. When we think about the concepts behind free software, Chris's focus is to look at this broadly as a sociological phenomenon to see how this method of innovation, this method of production, has implications and uses far outside the traditional technological world. And in that way, his work certainly mirrors and is part of is another part of or another side of work that Michelle Bowens of the Peer-to-Peer Foundation has written about and talked about on this show. And Chris advances those discussions in a very interesting direction, and one that we are going to be focusing on today with his term, the recursive public. And I'm not going to take time right now to define that term because I suspect we're going to be spending a fair amount of time discussing it with Chris. But the idea is, again, that free software itself, open source, and these new collaborative efforts have a startling and significant impact on how people interact, how they deal with, how they interact with their governments, and how they interact with society as a whole. Chris is joining us by telephone from Los Angeles, and Chris, I'm very excited to have you on the show today. So thank you for joining me on Hearsay Culture. We're recording on the day of the airing of the show on February 17th. Thank you for joining me today.
It's great to be here. Thanks very much for inviting me.
Chris, let's start off with a question I always ask authors and most people on the show. If you could talk a bit more about your background and how you became interested in this topic.
Sure. So as a PhD student, I was in a program at MIT called Science, Technology, and Society, which integrated training in history, the social sciences, and some field of science or engineering. And I was working on issues related to telemedicine and new technologies in healthcare and things like that in the Boston area, and talking with software engineers and whatnot, when I really sort of discovered in the mid-90s this thing called free software and debates around free software that were going on at the time. And it really piqued my interest and became something which I started to track more closely over the years. So it developed into a full-fledged project, which really I've spent probably about 10 years on now, if you count the time from when I first started investigating it until the present. And I do that work mostly as an anthropologist, mostly as someone who's interested in, as the subtitle of the book indicates, the cultural significance of these phenomena, trying to understand not just their economic or technical impacts, but how they change culture in general. And so that's where my focus has been primarily. But I also have training as a historian, so one of the ways I go about understanding the cultural significance is to explore the history of these phenomena. And the book is in large part a history of how free software and open source came to be what they are.
When people, and certainly this show airs, live in Silicon Valley, where these concepts are fairly well ingrained. But when you go outside the technology sphere, or people who are involved in the technology sector in the United States, and mention or use the phrase free software, what reaction do you get? What do people think is free software before you begin discussing it?
You know, I have the same problem that many people who are involved in free software and open source software does, and I solve it in the same way, which is often to say, you know, to use the tagline, which is so often used, free as in freedom, not as in beer, or free as in speech, not as in beer, which usually gets people thinking a little bit about the difference between software production practices that are oriented towards free speech or freedom of circulation versus those which are oriented towards mere or pure economic gain. And that usually gets people thinking about the issue a little bit. And the other way I do it that often sort of helps people understand why it's culturally significant is to raise the issue of intellectual property, because almost everyone has some cultural or pragmatic or common sense way in which they can relate to what intellectual property is. And if you start talking about that, then people can often, you know, find a handhold into what it is. I usually try and break it apart a little bit and say, you know, don't worry about the word software so much, because if that's what's scaring you, then you can recognize a bunch of different important cultural features in free software that aren't just about software, including intellectual property and collaboration and coordination and antitrust issues and pick your poison. So there are lots of things going on there, and there's always a way for someone to come into the problem, even if they seem to not care about software, or in a lot of cases, actually, it makes them kind of nervous.
From an anthropological standpoint, given your focus, is there a way that you approach, or a paradigm that you use in approaching legal issues?
Not really. Anthropologists have a long history of studying law as a domain which is much larger than the written law, right? And so, as opposed to most legal scholars, though certainly not all, anthropologists are really interested in the wide spectrum of everything from norms and morals and customs to written law to the effective policing of law. And so there are different traditions in anthropology that I draw on. Perhaps one of the most productive is the tradition in anthropology on gift exchange. Mm-hmm. And for anybody who knows the free software debate, they'll recognize this, because people within free software, in particular Eric Raymond, picked up on some aspects of this literature as an explanation for how free software might come to exist. And some of the literature in gift exchange suggests that it's an alternative economic model in which rather than strict exchange of money for goods, you have something more like a barter economy, or an exchange of one gift for another. It quickly becomes much more theoretically complicated once you look at the actual existing indigenous examples of gift exchange. But it's a good kind of object lesson for people to work with to understand why free software might exist, even though people aren't paid to produce free software.
Before we drill down on some of the details of the book and define some terms, I'm curious to know, was there a particular event or a realization that led to your effort to create and write this book, which covers the history of free software as well as its sociological and ultimately political implications? Was there an event or a realization that spurred you to endeavor?
In a funny way, there was. It was very personal. It was, it was learning. I knew what it was. I'd heard people talk about it, but it was just as alien as any other kind of software or development methodology or a set of ideas about intellectual property. But it was when I actually managed to install it and get it running on an old Macintosh that I had a kind of epiphany. Right? I thought, okay, there really is something going on here that once you dip into it, once you understand that, you know, a huge community of people have just made it possible for you to reconfigure and reuse your computer in this way. It was a real revelation at that point for me. And I think it was simultaneously that a technical thing, I actually have control over my devices that are around me, and a kind of communal thing. A lot of people work to make this happen, right? And and I wanted to understand why.
We're talking with Chris Kelty on KZSU FM Stanford, A Hearsay Culture. Chris, I want to open up our discussion of the book in particular, actually, by quoting you in your last paragraph, your conclusion to the book. You write, "Without free software, the only response to the continuing forms of excess we associate with illegitimate, unaccountable, unjust forms of governance might just be mute cynicism. With it," you go on, "we are in possession of a range of practical tools, structured responses, and clever ways of working through our complexity towards the promise of a shared imagination of legitimate and just governance." And I think to many listeners, they might be take a step back and say, wow, we're not just talking about, as you indicated, software. And so I do want to open up our discussion by asking you a fundamental question, which is, you discuss free software as having implications far beyond technology, right to our understanding of our form of government. As we think about free culture and we start defining its terms, are these kinds of concerns endemic or intrinsic in this movement, or are they outcomes or results from developing this process?
That's a great question, and the quotation might not sort of convey all of the complexity that goes into making such a statement.
Fair enough.
It never does, but I think that what's really important about free software is not what it causes to come into existence, or what, you can't treat it as something which all of a sudden appeared de novo in the 80s or 90s or whenever you want to pick the date, and then had a bunch of causes or effects that ramified through the culture. But rather you see it as a kind of concentrated point where a bunch of problems came together and emerged as this thing called free software, alternately open source software, and then it might break apart again into different components. So with the book, I was really trying to show people that, you know, in the same way that I said, don't worry about the software part, I was really trying to show people that it's made up of a set of practices which have come together in this particular thing called free software, which what lots of people recognize themselves as doing. And those practices, as they come together, might come apart again, but have impacts in lots of other fields. And so I was really concerned in the book to try and articulate how that happens historically, right? How it is that the practices of writing licenses and sharing software source code and collaborating on the internet come together in this thing, this singular thing called free software that lots of people recognize, and then all of a sudden get taken up by other people and used in different places in free culture. The case I explore in the book is the Rice University project on called Connection, open courseware. So there are these other places where people have said, hey, I recognize free software. That's dealing with a problem that I have. I want to apply it in these areas. And that's still going on. And I think that by understanding free software, you understand where those practices have come from and also potentially where they might and might not work, right? The reasons why it worked so well in the case of free software might also be exactly the same reasons why it doesn't work so well in educational terms or in music or in other domains like that. So that's sort of, you know, I really do think there's a bunch of practices going on that come together in this thing called free software, and it's not just free software that causes all of the things to happen.
So let's define a few terms. I know we can talk about some of the terminology you use in the book in particular, but again, comparing free software to what we know as open source, what are those countervailing, ultimately, or perhaps related definitions?
Right. So I organized the book around the year 1998 because, you know, I wanted to do this history of the recent past, but also concern about the near future in the book. And so 1998 was a really important year because it was the year that lots of people came together around the practices of free software and said, hey, there's really something going on here. And really, Netscape's release of the communicator's source code was an important event in that year that really brought people together. But there also, that was also the year that the term open source was proposed as an alternative. So all of a sudden, there were two terms for the same set of practices and two ideologies, which have become very familiar to anyone who's involved in this debate at all. And quite frankly, extremely tiring to most of the people involved in the debates. But on the one hand, you had people primarily concerned with freedom, information politics, the availability of software and the modifiability of software. And on the other hand, you had people who recognized a kind of new software development methodology in which you could rely on the distributed labor of lots of small contributions, the wisdom of crowds, in order to create something in a manner that we had never done so before. And so the difference there between open source and free software became a difference of ideology. In the book, I make the claim that actually the underlying practices of both, whether you called it open source or free software, it doesn't matter. Everybody does the same things. They use the same licenses. They use the same tools to coordinate and build software. They rely on the same infrastructure. So all the really, you know, the things that I think matter, really matter, are the same, whereas the ideologies on the surface are very opposed. And this is interesting because it's the opposite of a traditional social movement, right? In a traditional social movement like environmentalism, everyone agrees about the ideology. Oh, well, let's save the planet or let's save the forests. And they all differ on how what's the right way to do that, right? So it's a very peculiar kind of movement. It's often called a movement, but it really doesn't fit into the model of movements. And one of those reasons is because the ideologies are less important than the practices as opposed to the reverse.
Yeah, you know, you raise a great point here that I think is worth exploring a little more, because the idea of a creation of a good or service is having an ideology should strike, I think, it certainly strikes me as a bit odd. We're dealing with productive processes, but it's the underlying, it seems, the underlying impact of these processes that create a ideological bent. You know, when you talk about movements, you know, there are certain sectors and industries that get nervous with that phrase as well. And as you know, certainly in intellectual property world, there's been this concept of cultural environmentalism that is born out of modeling the environmental movement that you refer to, in an effort to increase collaboration and ultimately, at some level, reconfigure or depending on your view, rebalance intellectual property rights to allow for greater creativity. But this choice of the word movement seems problematic. You know, being someone that's thought about and been involved in this activity, I'll call it, for quite a long time, is there another term or phrase that you would like to use? In other words, does the word movement ultimately matter?
Well, that's a bit of a setup now, isn't it? because the term I use in the book is public, right? And in
yes.
particular, recursive public.
Yes.
But and there's a good academic reason that I do that, which I can go into if we want to talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
But I really did object to the use of movement here, since there is a long tradition of studying social movements, starting from the 1960s and into the 90s, that has been very effective at understanding how movements work, how they're organized, what role leadership plays, and even to some extent what role technology plays. And none of that really applies in quite the same way to free and open source software. So it wasn't the right tool for the job, academically speaking. Now, empirically speaking, out there in the world, all the people involved in free software are saying of themselves, we're part of the free software movement. People say that about free culture, we're part of the free culture movement. So there's a sense in which that term has a salience, a meaning that people really want to, you know, they want to apply to themselves, right? I want to be part of a movement. And the reason is because they want to stand outside of organized power, right? It's not the Free Software Corporation. It's not the Free Software Non-Governmental Organization. It's not the Free Software 501(c), even if it is. It's the Free Software Movement. And the same, to some extent, goes for open source, though people who call themselves open source advocates generally do not talk about being in a movement, though some do. And it's just a little bit less common. So if you're talking about an organization or a kind of an association of people that stands outside of power, the proper academic term for that is the public sphere, right? The public sphere was always imagined as this place that stood outside of governmental power and offered a critique of it, which the governmental sphere had to listen to, right? That's at the origin of our understanding of democratically accountable regimes which respond to public spheres. So in a lot of ways, the terminology from an academic perspective around public spheres is much more accurate than that of the movements, though calling it the free software public sphere, it didn't have the same ring to it, I guess.
So, so I didn't quite intend it that way, but you're right. I did tee up a definitional question for you, so I'll just ask it outright. You coined the term or the phrase recursive public early on in your book. So what does that mean?
Yeah. So if you follow what I'm saying about public spheres as these associations, these places outside of constituted power, outside of the government, or also outside of the church or the corporation, as a kind of a space where people can offer criticism and argument, which the institutions of power have to listen to and incorporate, then you have a concept of the public sphere there. Most of the academic writing on public spheres does not take account of technology or the role of technology. It's either totally absent or a minor variable in understanding democratic politics. What I saw happening in free software were people really engaged with creating that space, that availability of public critique at every level, not just in an application like, an image editor, a free software image editor, but also at the level of the operating system and at the level of the application programming interfaces, at the level of the internet protocols even, embracing an idea that these things have to be open and reconfigurable in order to ensure that the next generation is also open and reconfigurable. And so I was trying to capture how that kind of technical work is also political at that level, even though most of the people involved would probably disavow that what they were doing was political work. Some recognize it as political. But I really saw a kind of effort to create a public sphere there through technical means. And so, I used the term of art from computer science of recursion in order to try and signal that this was a public sphere that was also technically mediated, that it had had to do with creating things in software and with thinking about levels of abstraction and abstraction barriers and things like that. And so the recursive public was supposed to indicate that.
Are there communities, are there entities for which you believe or think that this movement or this process does not or cannot belong?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the public sphere doesn't cover everything. It's a temporary space. It's a fragile space in democratic theory. Right, it's something where people really have to be there paying attention in order to be part of a recursive public. I guess the question is always at what level of the infrastructure that we're building in the information society do we need this public sphere, right? And for at least the last 10 years, free software has really been focused at the level of the personal computer and the operating system, I would say. 10 or 15 years earlier than that, you saw a lot of debates in what I write about in the book over open systems, the kind of attempt to create a networked infrastructure built on a global network. And there were debates about what the right network would be or would look like. And it turns out that the internet won that debate, though, for some surprising reasons. So there are always questions, I think, at any historical moment of what's the right level to be focusing this public critique? And I think that actually raises a really interesting question right now, because the right level in some ways is cloud computing, right? The kind of things that Google and Yahoo and Facebook and all of the Web 2.0 companies are really focused on, allowing people to access applications that are in the cloud. And that's the space right now where we need a recursive public, and we don't have one, right? We have a recursive public vis-a-vis personal computers and operating systems on our desktops, but certainly not at the level of cloud computing.
We are talking with Chris Kelty of UCLA, author of the book Two Bits, The Cultural Significance of Free Software. Chris, I think I do want to, after we take a short break for a public service announcement, talk about the intersection specifically of free software and intellectual property law. But before we do that, I'm going to ask one more foundational question, which is you discuss in the book five core components of free software. And I know that, of course, that could take up the next several hours if we got into the details. So I continually ask unfair questions, even though we have the better part of an hour to have discussions. So I'm going to ask you to, in a brief way, identify what those five core components are.
Sure. So I'll try and give the one sentence answer to both to all five of them, and preface that by saying I wanted to identify the sort of necessary and sufficient conditions for free software to be recognizable to people who call themselves free software or open source adherents. So these five practices were supposed to be the things that you would recognize yourself in if you were a member of those groups. So the first is this ideological level of free software versus open source and the debates and disputes that go on at that level. The second is the practice of sharing software source code, which sounds like it's obvious, you just share it, but it actually took 20, 30 years to really develop the techniques for doing that, and that's also the history of the Unix operating system. The third is the creation of a shared and open infrastructure, which I tell in the book, the sort of origins of the Internet and the PC architecture through the story of the debates about the open systems, the attempt to create open systems in the 1980s. The fourth are techniques for collaboration and coordination, especially widely used tools like simple ones like mailing lists for coordinating work on a project, and more complicated ones like software source code management systems, which are clever software tools for letting people work on the same source code at the same time without stepping on each other's toes. And then the last one, which we can talk about more after the break, is the intellectual property component, the copyleft license. Right. So for a lot of people, that copyleft license is what defines free software, but for me, it's one of five things. And sometimes for a lot of people, the coordination and collaboration is what defines open source software. But for me, it's all five of those taken together.
We're talking with Chris Kelty of UCLA, author of the book Two Bits, The Cultural Significance of Free Software on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to this show regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue their diverse programming. If you're interested in making a donation to KZSU, you have a couple of ways that you can do this. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our website at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I do hope that you continue to keep listening to KZSU and Hearsay Culture. So Chris, I wanted to, at this point in the interview, rather than, blast through every concept that you raise in a book that totals over 350 pages, to drill down on a couple of areas that I think would be of particular interest to the listeners of Hearsay Culture. And as you indicated, recognizing that the free software community has more than one pillar, certainly a focus of concern and of conflict has been a perceived conflict with intellectual property law. And so I guess I'll ask you this fundamental question that you've alluded to certainly and maybe answered a little bit, but we can dig into more deeply, which is the perception that free software and the free software movement, to use that phrase, is a threat to those that believe that IP law needs to exist in a strong form and that it is under attack. So the ultimate question becomes, is this movement intrinsically one that should be perceived as a threat to strong IP?
So, I'd like to just say no and then move on to the next one, but there's a long answer to that, and there's a short answer to it. And the short answer is probably the better one, which is, The whole idea of copyleft licenses and free software as an intellectual property phenomenon would not exist without the intellectual property system as it stands. In some ways, it's a critique of the existing intellectual property, but it really depends on the intellectual property system to exist. And, this is a place where we should probably talk more specifically about copyright law in particular. And, what the copyleft licenses do and the copyright licenses do is to actually take a very clever advantage of the rights given to people by the statutory law. So it's not a threat in any fashion because it's using the rights that people have in a very clever way, which is namely to say, I've been given very, very strong rights through copyright law over the dispensation of my work, and I'm going to use those rights to very, very widely distribute the work that I create. And so there's certainly nothing criminal about it. There's certainly nothing extra legal about it. It's all within the existing copyright system. Now, you could draw the implication that people are doing that because they think the copyright system should be different. But I don't think that's actually the case. You know, there are some people who would argue that we really do need to change the intellectual property system generally and the copyright system in particular. But there are also many people who are just fine with this hack, right? This way of using the copyright system in order to distribute things. I mean, at some level, you have to agree with the sentiment that if you give people strong rights in the form of copyright over their materials, you have to give them the right to choose whether or not to make those things freely available or to keep them close. And if you don't give them that right, then you really are creating a restrictive copyright system and sort of forcing people to do one thing or the other. So that was supposed to be the short answer.
Well, we have a little more time, so we can dig a little more deeply. You know, as you discuss those five components, of course, one of them that you mentioned is this concept, as you talked about, of conceptualizing openness. And all of these phrases that are used, I think, are perceived as, in one way or another, as you mentioned, being an all or nothing equation. Either you have openness mm-hmm. or you don't. Either you have right. copyright protection or you don't. There was an interesting situation that popped up, and I'll summarize it for you. Although if you're more familiar with it, I won't, but certainly for the benefit of the listeners, I will. The Coranti website that has the focus of CopyFight, the CopyFight blog had a post. Again, this show being recorded on the 17th yesterday, regarding the work of the mathematician Alexander Grothendieck, and I think I'm pronouncing his name properly, and they were citing to Steve Lamberg's blog, and it tells the story, okay, a basic story, which I'll summarize here, that Grothendieck had developed and written 20 volumes for a European publisher that were considered to be revolutionary in the world of mathematics. And he published these works. They totaled 6,200 pages. The mathematics community built entire disciplines around them, and they are currently out of print. So a group of mathematicians, and this is the connection to free software and to collaboration and to open this ultimately, got together to basically transcribe these manuscripts, because they were hand-typed and they were of limited availability even in libraries, to transcribe them and correct any typos and fix mathematical symbols that were handwritten in the original manuscript. And the belief was, because Grothendieck has not been publicly available, as CopyFight refers to him, a reclusive mathematician, that he wouldn't have a problem with this behavior. And after 8 years of work, two of these 20 volumes were produced, at which time Grothendieck appeared by letter to say, stop everything. I don't want any of my work distributed this way. Stop what you're doing. And it apparently has ground this effort to a halt. Is that the kind of situation that concerns you from a free software perspective? In other words, is this the kind of situation that you think engenders the concerns about which you, I think, are understandably frustrated? Or is this a situation outside the scope of what we consider to be this movement?
Yeah, that's a really interesting example. I think it's a little bit too individualized, maybe, to be compared to what's going on in free software. You know, it's pretty clear that, you know, at least the way the law is written and the way we think about the rights of the author, Grothendieck, if that's how you say it, has some rights there, right? Who over the dispensation of this work, over what people do with it, but you know, whoever published it originally also has some rights, and so there's a dispute there, and who knows why he doesn't want it published, right? Like, maybe he thinks it's wrong now or something, right? You know, so got to give him some credit for having things having a say over it. I think the case in free software is slightly different, and the example that I like to use is there are a lot of people in the software industry who work for, you know, software corporations as developers, who create really valuable tools, and they make a lot of money doing it, and maybe someone buys it, or they make a good salary or whatnot, And by virtue of this, they can get hired by other corporations to do the same thing. But when they go to that other corporation, that software is going to stay with the original corporation, right? They're not going to be able to take it with them. And they're going to have to rebuild it there. And that is a tremendously painful thing to have to do. It's almost as painful as what it sounds like these mathematicians are doing, retranscribing what Grothendieck wrote in these manuscripts, right? It's a really painful thing, and it's doubly painful because that individual programmer has to redo it all over again and can't move on to the next hard problem, right? So free software is a way of saying, well, look, you know, it's great to remunerate people for creating these things when they're created, but we should avoid a situation where they have to reinvent them every time they take a new job or every time a new corporation comes around, right? Once we build really high-quality, workable, tested infrastructure, we shouldn't have to rebuild it every time people move around or new corporations come along. And that's more of a communal and a question of the organization of industry and economy. And I think it's a cultural thing as well. You know, like, people react badly to having to rebuild the wheel, to reinvent the wheel. And that's where we're at with free software right now, is that people don't want to have to rebuild things, and free software is a way around that. So that's why you see, you know, 75% of the people working on Linux right now are, in fact, the big corporations, mm-hmm. IBMs and Suns and so on, contributing code, because it's become a kind of commodity infrastructure, and they want it to be really good, and they don't want to have to rebuild it every time they create a new product.
And that was going to be the next area I wanted to ask you about, which was ultimately, is the fact that this idea of development has become more commonplace and has been embraced by traditional commercial entities, does that serve, in your view, as some kind of stamp of approval from established industry that this isn't such a threat after all?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think at this point for the software industry and for Silicon Valley, it's not a threat. But people don't see free software and open source as a threat anymore, mm-hmm. and especially at the level of infrastructural technologies. You know, where it's still a threat, as I mentioned before, is in places like cloud computing, right? It doesn't make any sense for Google to open source Google Docs, right? Because it just creates a possibility for immediate competitors to set up their own server farm and compete with them at that level. So there is a threat there. But as I said, that's not where free software is focused. Free software is focused on the desktop, on the operating system, on the infrastructure of the internet. So at that level, I really don't think it's kind of, the game is a little bit over in that respect, mm-hmm. with respect to whether free software is a threat.
So that I think is an interesting realization, because it certainly was the focus for years of concern. So as we transition and look at where for the free software elements and free software methods can move, one area that your book talks about, and I think as you mentioned, perhaps it has even more relevance today, is this intersection with government. So where is the nexus there, and what do you see as the predominant issue in the relationship between government and the methods you describe?
Yeah, there's a couple of places where that's clearly getting a lot of traction. The most obvious one that everyone will be familiar with at some level is the Obama campaign, right, in 2008. And you know, what I think is interesting about that is that it's, you know, underneath the hood, if you look underneath the hood, it's all running free software, right? So infrastructurally, it's depending on the same kinds of advances that free software introduced for Google. Above that level, you might not necessarily associate it with free software, but that's why I'm interested in the cultural significance of it, right? The fact that we can build these infrastructures quickly and have them work relatively well, especially in the domain of information technology, where things usually don't work so well, it can have profound effects, right? And the Obama campaign is a good example of that. But the other place where I think it's happening is with cases like the Sunlight Foundation, and your listeners would probably be interested to check out what the Sunlight Foundation is doing. But it's promoting lots of different techniques for getting access to government data and government publications and getting involved in the running of government, not just critique at the level of, do you agree with this policy or do you not agree with this policy? Do you want to vote for this candidate? Do you not want to vote for this candidate? But really getting into the details and helping solve problems at the level of the running of the government. And that, I think, is where this, you know, cultural significance of free software is leading people towards direct involvement in their own government in a profound sense.
We're talking with Chris Kelty of UCLA, author of the book Two Bits, The Cultural Significance of Free Software. And yes, Chris, that is something that I think I do want to focus on. We had on the show, and it's a couple of years ago now, Steve Aftergood from the Federation of American Scientists, who puts out a regular newsletter on secrecy efforts in government. And I do want to turn in our remaining 10 or so minutes to issues of transparency that you certainly address towards the end of the book, and that I think are quite interesting. When we think about open government and accountability and transparency, the Obama administration, and I don't want to get into politics, certainly has a mixed record, but they have put forth a groundbreaking effort, and I think the Sunlight Foundation was one of the organizations that identified it as a groundbreaking effort in attempting to allow more records to be made public. And they've pushed for not only, not perhaps revisions of the Freedom of Information Act, but certainly a more charitable view towards disclosure and interpretation of the Freedom of Information Act, and have, through executive order, encouraged agencies to put forth their own plans for getting records out there more quickly. And this does strike me as a form of the kind of movement that you're describing. But, of course, it raises the question of changing the structure of government itself and how it's operated traditionally for centuries. Can you have a movement that deals with collaboration and openness and work effectively inside a government structure that traditionally has put a high priority on secrecy and you know, certainly a lack of transparency?
Well, it's a great question. I don't know. I think that's what the Sunlight Foundation wants to find out at some level. I mean, let me just back up a little bit and say, mm-hmm. you know, to return to the discussion about public spheres, right? The ways in which we conventionally know how to interact with our government in a public sphere are very recognizable. You know, we pick up our banners and we march, we wave our signs, we sign petitions, we do all of these things that we recognize as trying to tell the government, this is how you should do things, right? This is what you should change, right? Here's our protest, please listen to us. The Sunlight Foundation and the sort of the free software ethic, as it were, taken to the levels of working on transparency in government or working on actually changing the structure of the government is a way of saying, well, let's muck with the guts of it, right? Let's open up the hood and see how it works and propose alternatives and see which of these alternatives turn out to be the ones we can agree on will make a significant difference. And that's, in sort of the way I think about these things, that's a new form of engagement in the public sphere. And one of the problems with it is that it's really accessible only to people who think in that little kind of geeky way, right? If you're schooled in thinking about technology and thinking about, or even thinking about IP law, then you have an advantage here in participating in that public sphere, whereas other people who are afraid of computers or don't want to open up the hood of their computer can't really get into that movement. But nonetheless, it really is a way of saying, well, let's expand the definition of what the public sphere is here to include, you know, looking at how FOIA works, and not just how the law works, but how the actual agency works, and whether or not we can write software to help them do it better, or open up the internet in a way so that it's easier to get documents out, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of open questions for people to work on.
And, you know, it leads me actually back to a question that I meant to ask at the beginning of the show, but I'll ask now, which is, of course, the meaning of the title, Two Bits. How does that fit into this larger equation that we're discussing? Probably should have asked that at the very beginning. I meant to. So now I'll ask it now towards the end.
The title is just supposed to be a sort of catchy way to incorporate both the idea of information technology and the cultural significance of part of it, by which I really, you know, wanted to indicate that money is part of that, two bits, a quarter, right? Like when you talk about free software, people automatically assume you're talking about free as in price. And, you know, it's this kind of very, really probably far too subtle nod towards it's not free as in price, but it's at least as cheap as 25 cents, right? so the two bits was meant to be sort of catchy in that respect. The press that put out the book was extremely generous in letting me do all kinds of things that they don't usually let people do, including, you know, agreeing to a title which they thought wouldn't work as well, and allowing me to release the book under a Creative Commons license, and But they even took some steps like using an open source font in the book and thinking about its circulation in some ways. So they saw it as an experiment as well.
So. We are talking with Chris Kelty, the author of Two Bits, The Cultural Significance of Free Software on KZSU. Chris, we have about 7 or 8 minutes left, and so this is the time in the show where I definitely start asking the unfair questions, defined as a question that cannot be answered adequately in the time we have left. So I'm gonna start out with the ultimate crystal ball question, which is, as you forecast where we're headed over the next couple of years, obviously this book came out in 2008, so we're a couple of years from its publication. If you look ahead the next 2 years or so, where do you see this this methodology having the most success and the most resistance?
Well, I think I'll put my money where my research is going, and that's in thinking about the life sciences and the problems faced by doing effective life science research today, and how the principles of free software might be applied in that domain. And there's been actually quite a lot of attention to this by scientists, bioinformatics people, and also citizens groups of various sorts. People have probably read an article or two about do-it-yourself biology as a kind of analog to the free software movement. People out there creating engineering biological organisms to do things in their homes or community labs or things like that. So I think that there will continue to be a lot of attention in that area. It's a much harder problem in some ways than software, but that's also met by just as much creativity and as much energy and probably considerably more money in that domain than even in software. And so I use the analytical framework of the book to ask questions about what's going on in the life sciences right now. And I think that, that's one place to look. Just to give one example, an important difference between the domain of software and that of life sciences is that software is all about copyright, and that's why free software has worked so well in intellectual property terms. Biology is all about patents, right? So we're really shifting the focus from the copyright system to the patent system and asking what kinds of hacks of the patent system should people be engaging in? Can they make the patent system do what they want it to do? Should it be changed? All of those things are questions that are quite lively right now, I think.
And I guess since you've raised it, and boy, this is even a more unfair question than I thought I was asking an unfair question at the beginning, but now I'm really going to ask an unfair question since you brought it up. The the patent system granting a limited monopoly, which makes it impossible to directly infringe, obviously, whatever the patented invention is, I mean, short of a workaround, would seem to be a system that's much less conducive to the kind of free software concepts that you are thinking about. Intrinsically, do you think the patent law system is capable of dealing with a methodology that implicitly suggests that we're going to not only improve upon what's been invented, but we're going to perhaps use it directly or indirectly?
Yeah. I won't say absolutely not, but it's pretty clear that it's much, much harder than in the case of copyright. There's certainly no direct analog of what you can do with copyright law in the patent regime. In fact, for most people interested in something like free software in biology, the advice is put it in the public domain, mm-hmm. right? Just publish, just make it freely available. It's better than, it's going to cost you $50,000 to get a patent anyways. So, the patent can't necessarily be made to do that. But where I think there is some room for creativity and investigation is in dealing with the absolutely massive database of material that we have now in the patent repositories, right? And there are people who are looking at this massive amount of data and saying, what can we do with this in order to help people navigate through the existing patents to find a kind of space of operation in which they can do what they want to do without infringing patents. So there might be clever ways to work through the patent system if you're trying to avoid infringing on patents. But I doubt very much that it's going to look like copyleft in the copyright regime.
And there doesn't appear, except certainly, obviously, the current battle that the Supreme Court is going to have to decide in the Bilski case with respect to patenting abstract
right.
ideas. There doesn't seem to be an enormous groundswell of support for having these kinds of radical changes as we see in the copyright sphere.
I think actually one of the places it's changing that is worth paying attention to is in technology transfer offices in universities,
mm-hmm.
where for years now, people have been patenting as much as they can and spending a lot of money to get patents under the assumption that revenue will start flowing and the universities will become rich beyond their wildest dreams. And most universities have, I can't speak for my own because it is actually one of the winners in this game, but most universities have realized that that's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question in technology transfer offices is not, should we stop patenting, but how do we measure the impact of our research in ways other than licensing revenue, right? So I think there's a lot of attention focused right now on how you measure the impact that your scientists and engineers are having on the world without just looking at licensing revenue.
And it would seem, of course, that the university would be an ideal place where these, and in fact, the genesis, perhaps, to some degree, of these ideas in the first instance. So we've engrafted upon universities that have the tradition of knowledge sharing this monetizing concept that comes out of Bayh-Dole and other laws. And there is the free software movement to perhaps offer some solutions. Fascinating stuff. And as usual, of course, the conversation ends. Perhaps just as certain people would like to hear more, which is why I get to do two things right now. First is to certainly invite you back on the show to continue the discussion, and I look forward to doing that down the road, but also to ask you, for those people that want to learn more about your work, I know you have a blog as well as a website for the book, 2bits.net. Anywhere else you recommend people to look?
That's primarily for the work on the book. Mm-hmm. The site for my own research and everything is kelty.org. And there are other things in the works at the Center for Society and Genetics, but there's no place to visit just yet for that. So if people are interested in the do-it-yourself biology stuff, there's a site called outlawbiology.net, which was something that I just ran, and they're, you know, there's always Google. You can find out more than I want you to know about me.
Yes. That certainly is endemic of the search engine society, as Alves called it. Chris Kelty, author of the book, 2bits, The Cultural Significance of Free Software. Chris, thank you so much for being on the show today. This was a great conversation. I look forward to having you back down the road.
Here. Thank you very much.
Thank you kindly.
I really appreciate it.
So I'm very excited to mention a number of guests that are upcoming on the show, and this in general order will be the list of guests for the remaining three shows that are left in the semester. After next week, I plan to have on, hopefully, Shubha Ghosh from the University of Wisconsin. In addition, in March, I'm looking forward to chatting with Professor Manuel Castells from the University of Southern California, Annenberg School of Communication, who has written his most recent book, Communication Power. Laura DeNardis, the Executive Director of the Information Society Project at Yale Law School and author of Protocol Politics, A Globalization of Internet Governance. Additionally, I look forward to chatting with Professors Daniel Citron of the University of Maryland School of Law and Frank Pasquale of Seton Hall Law School discussing fusion centers. Professor Beth Novak of New York Law School, who's currently serving as the Deputy Chief Technology Officer at the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, who will be on the show. Professor C. Vivedyanathan of the University of Virginia will be on discussing his book, The Googleization of Everything. Professor Bobby Quall from DePauw College of Law will be on as well. And Greg Nogi, the Senior Counsel at the Center for Democracy and Technology. As always, you have a number of ways that you can listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen to the show live on KZSU, 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays by tuning into KZSU or streaming it live at kzsulive.stanford.edu. If you prefer to listen by podcast, you have a number of options. You can go to hearsayculture.com where you can pick up all of the previous shows and look at the schedule. You can subscribe to Stanford's Center for Internet Society iTunes page where you will get a feed of not only Hearsay Culture but other events at CIS. Or you can also pick up the RSS feed at CIS's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. For those of you that are interested, to the extent that you are going to be in New York City, I will be at a conference next week at the New School on limiting knowledge, actually apropos of our discussion here, discussing issues of, I will not be presenting, I should say. I'll just merely be attending, but I'll be there. If anyone is going to be in that area, or perhaps even at that conference, I'd love to hear from you. That'll be next week, next Thursday and Friday, I believe. Otherwise, I will continue to attempt to mention places I will be to the extent that people are around, and I'd certainly love to meet anyone listening to the show and chat about these issues. You can email me at dave@hearsayculture.com, and I also welcome any comments, suggestions, feedback, and so forth. So, thank you so much for listening today to Hearsay Culture. I hope you enjoyed the discussion. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and I will talk to you next week.